It's Wednesday, February 14th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 39 of Fear the Booth, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Booth. My name is Dan, and with me today is Chad.
Howdy.
Adam.
Hi.
Mike.
Hello.
And John.
Hey.
Alrighty. Chad, I understand that you've done a great and horrible thing, and we're going to get your report on that, but first we need to get a report on a different great and horrible thing.
Oh, God.
John, how was your date?
My date went very well.
Explain.
I'll let you connect the dots.
We had sushi. Is it true she had facial hair?
No, she didn't have facial hair.
Is it true it was Chad?
Maybe. I'll let you think about it. Chad may or may not have facial hair. You could rule that out or you could not at your leisure.
All right, so where did you guys go?
We went to a place in the Central West End called Shiyun. Good eel.
Shiyun? What is this place?
It's a sushi place. Your standard Japanese fare.
All right, good.
For the discerning young 21 faux intellectual.
Okay. Is this the kind of girl you took out at a 21 faux intellectual?
Absolutely.
Oh, good.
I myself am, in fact, the 21-year-old faux intellectual.
She has all kinds of pseudo-educated ideas on places she's never been, people she's never met, and processes she's never been a part of.
As do I. That's the American way,
so
thank you.
So this podcast
so
way.
You yeah. did go out with Chad.
Maybe.
John just likes chicks with beards.
That's all I go for. I need a dwarf woman.
So, John, tell me about her. What's she into?
She's into John G., naturally. What the hell else are all the ladies into?
So that's the length and breadth of her existence.
You, oh, and quite a length date. It is.
Uh-huh. You wouldn't believe the number of emails I get, mostly from Playboy Playmates, demanding more John G. on Twitter.
Oh, I would believe them. I get them myself.
I mean, look at that chiseled jaw.
I stave them off. You boys know damn well what does 1d6 damage. And is, in fact, a simple weapon.
A blunt weapon?
Yes.
All right, so, Chad, yes. While John was off doing this, you were doing something scarier.
I was gaming in the window of a hobby shop in a mall.
Now, for those of you that have been with us for quite a while, this is a horror that we spoke of way back in the single-digit episodes, back when Fear the Boot was still recorded on a phonograph machine cut into a wax cylinder.
That Edison himself gave us.
And was distributed by gyrocopter. So, Chad?
A whirly gig, if you will. It was really an interesting experience. It was Wednesday. It was War Machine night up at Clicks. And the room in back was quite full. I think we get about 15, maybe 20 people up there. That it gets packed really quick for War Machine. So me and Einherjar on our forums was we were playing a few rounds and we just didn't have anywhere else to play. We're like, well, where do you want to play? Like, he's like, let's play in the fishbowl. And they have this window that's kind of bowed out because it used to be a shoe store and that's where they like set up their product and stuff. So I'm like, yeah, sure, let's do it. And we set up and we played in the window. It was a very interesting experience to see that 90% of the people walked by completely ignored us.
And would point at you and say, freak,
freak. And then a very small percentage, I would say about in the two games that we played, probably about five or so people stopped, walked up to the window and looked at what we were doing, the models, the games and stuff. Two people went so far as to walk inside and kind of look down at what we were doing. These people were not in any way obvious gamers. You know, they didn't have the black t-shirts with the witty gaming sayings on them or anything.
Did they have the peta smile?
No, they did not have the peta smile.
So they were interested in the game and not you.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't think any pedophile would be into
it. Chad's a wee bit old for a peta smile. He doesn't exactly have that clean-shaven, girlish look about him.
Yeah, but have you seen Einherjar?
Yeah, that's true.
He does look a little young.
Yeah, he does have a sort of youthful zeal about him.
Hey, but, nothing wrong with a little youthful zeal.
But, no.
This show just got creepy.
No,
well, Johnny G., you're about 12. How many guys did you hit on in a day?
Oops. None.
So, Chad, go on.
So, anyway, people would, like, actually walk in. You know, two people walked in and were kind of looking, and one guy, his girlfriend kind of trailed in, and she's like, come on, let's go. I don't want to be here. It's freaky. It's like, this is really cool. I've never seen anything like what? And I kind of looked at it. We're playing a game called War Machine. So I said to him, and he's like, oh, it's War Machine. You know, kind of looking at her and speaking with authority. Yeah. Oh, it's War Machine. I just got to thinking about how gaming shops who have that sort of window and have a game night of some sort should have somebody, like an employee or something, standing by the door. They should tell people to play in the window. And when people stop and look, maybe hand them a brochure or something, some material that they can take with them. Because Dave and I were talking about how these people aren't, who were looking, is in as far as I could tell, we're not into gaming in any way. I think it was a pretty safe assumption to make that because our little niche is very small. And
even if it's not a safe assumption, we'll make it anyway.
You know, if these people would just take a one or two more steps into the store and inquire about it, they could pick up a really fun and new hobby. You know, it's just that there was that sort of block there that this is intriguing, but it's different, and it's outside of my comfort
zone. You ever had one of those things in your life where it's completely common sense? It's just kind of a duh sort of thing, but you just really never thought about it until somebody says something, then it kind of clicks. Excuse the pun.
They're not called clicks anymore, though.
I know, they're game night now. I guess it's kind of, hearing you say this, we wondered way back when why anyone would game in the window of a gaming shop, and we gave all the reasons back then we won't go through again. I just kind of had this duh sort of moment that, you know, even if this is mildly humiliating to the people that are doing it, it's probably a great advertisement for the store within.
Well, why does Adam walk around in a trench coat and expose himself? Some people just like
indeed?
To do these sort of things.
I would be interested to see how successful it would be to have, like, a shop with a window like that and have somebody gaming and then have an attractive young woman, because all the people who stopped were guys, have an attractive young woman standing out there, and she's wearing a t-shirt with the hobby shop logo, handing out some literature, not to every single person who passed by, but just kind of
only to the
out.
Lonely-looking dudes who think they would pick up a game.
Like we had the Fear of the Boot girls at Archon.
Yeah, we did. Actually,
and
they
worked a great really well.
And, you know, if you wanted to do that experiment, you know somebody who owns a gaming store, yeah. And you know
a girl who really likes getting attention from nerds
wearing very skin-tight shirts over a big rack.
I do indeed. It would be an interesting social experiment, I think.
Fear the Boot, the research group.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. We could get academic credibility.
Yeah. We have one talk with Ryan Dancy, and now we are the experts.
Yes. On everything.
First St. Peter's, then the world.
We weren't the experts before Ryan Dancy?
Not about demographics, you see.
Okay, fair enough.
He gave us some insight we couldn't have gotten on our own. But you know what? Now that we have it, we have it.
Time to run with it.
We are standing on the shoulders of giants, or at least ogres of at least 4 hit dice.
So looking around this table at all the people gathered here in the warm glow of the mixer.
All the beautiful men.
The bearded men.
Continue.
Talking about John being chased by pedophiles was less creepy than you calling me beautiful.
You don't have a beard. I wasn't talking to you.
Okay.
But he does have a bedroom voice.
He does.
So we found out worldwide wing night.
At least according to one listener.
One male listener at that.
One male listener.
Thanks, Francis.
Yeah. Couldn't have been a beautiful woman that tells me I have a bedroom voice. No, it was a guy.
A guy who's been stuck in Afghanistan for month after torturous month.
So as I look around this table, for pretty much all of my gaming career, I have been a game master. I have logged probably, 10 to 1 hours game mastering as I have playing.
We're sick of it, too.
I don't know if it's that bad, but I would have probably 2 or 3 to 1.
To my left is Chad, who I know did not game master for most of his career and picked it up later, I believe, mostly out of necessity because there were no other game masters or even really experienced gamers in your group.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
All right. Next to him is Adam, who is even right now doing his first round of game mastering ever that I'm aware.
No, this isn't my first round. This is
your first one to escape orbit.
The first successful round of game mastering.
Skip over Mike for a moment.
Oh, God. Here we go.
I am game mastering a group of newbies through some Dungeons & Dragons right now.
But historically, have you been more player or game master?
I would say more game master. Not with this group, the Fear the Boot group, but most of the time when we gathered around the table and someone had to GM, It was me.
Okay. So sitting between Adam and John is Mike. Now, with Mike, I have been gaming with Mike for almost as long as either of us has been gaming. We did have some gaming experience before he and I met, but we've been, you know, part of the same gaming group now since 1992. So it's been a long time. I mean, John and Adam were not even born yet.
Accurate.
He said 92.
Oh. Oh, never mind.
How old do you think we are?
Oh, sorry. I thought you guys were 20-ish. No, you're 30-ish. My bad.
Yeah, that sucks, doesn't it?
So, Mike, for a lot of your career, at least early on, you were a game master.
Early on, yes, I was.
Ran for some other groups, ran for our group.
That's right.
And certainly your games, like everyone's games back then, had some immaturity, had some kind of childish aspects to them, like everyone's game did at that point in their life.
I was a teenager, sure.
But overall, you were basically a really good game master. And then somewhere around, I guess it's like 1994, 1995, you stopped and have never GM'd since.
Oh, okay. So he stopped being a GM, not stopped being good.
As a clarification that did need to be made.
That's right. I've not been a game master since the mid-90s. That's true.
Wow.
Explain.
Some people that are sitting around this table now love to break my games and mm-hmm. complain about my games, mm-hmm. and so I eventually got burned out and stopped GMing.
John, I'm ashamed of you.
Yeah, it was John. Yes. That's who I mean.
Back when I was 10, attending the fourth grade, I was just busting Mike's games left and right.
Okay.
20-year-old Mike was like, that crazy kid!
But here's the thing. Of course, at the time, those of us that were involved in your gaming group, namely Chad and I, also, our characters were as equally immature, and we, as people, were equally immature.
Oh, yeah.
So why is it that now that we are all aged and wizened men, have you not come back to the table with a powerful return to game mastering?
Well, as you know, I was creating a campaign that recently got lost because my stupid digital voice recorder lost its batteries and somehow had no memory of its own. But for the last 10 years, I've not GM'd because I guess I don't want to get smacked down with my GMing, because while immature playing seems to be acceptable in certain circles, immature GMing gets a lot of criticism.
Well, you know what? I've GM'd for both Chad and Dan now. I completely understand. It's awful.
Exactly.
You ever hear a word of complaint from John G., Adam?
Have you ever GM'd for Chad and Dan?
Yes, I have.
Both at the same time?
No.
Just you've never GM'd for Dan?
No, he's never
GM'd. Okay, so we'll we'll ignore the green comment from over there.
Part of the problem is when you are playing with people who are GMs themselves, they have in their mind...
Yes, the doctors make the worst patients.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's sort of one of the things that we ran up against, is that in Dan's considerable GMing experience, when Dan has to be a player, he is a little more hard on GMs at times. Or
yeah,
at least
actually,
has been
I'd
in the
say
past.
It's the reverse.
I would say it's the reverse,
it's
too.
It's my option that GMs make the best players because they... Assuming they're not vindictive, which I can tell you I am not, having been through a lot of difficulty, I tend to be far more forgiving, at least in recent years as a GM, than most players I've seen ever.
I would know, because I haven't GM'd in recent years.
Well, I would have to say my experience comes with our group, Adam, John, them, before Dan came back into my life. The only person who was like a real heavy game master was John. He was my best player because he understood.
That's right.
It was like this big juggling act. And if I couldn't get to John, or if I was dealing with these issues over here with running my game and making sure everything was going good, I could just give John a look and be like, hey, man, I'm sorry. I got to do this. And he's like, don't worry, man. I understand. I've been there. Or it was like, you know, the group is going one way. I could lean over to John and say, John, could you maybe get him to go the
there
other
were a
way?
Few corrupt, you know, bargains made in the years we've been gaming.
Nothing is so overt of either of us saying that, but
of course,
you
not.
Know, the nod, the wink, well, the nudge.
I've even seen stuff where it's like a GM will ruffle my feathers as a player because, like, this is BS. I don't like it. I don't like the way it's taking the game or my character, but I can see as a fellow GM what it is he's trying to accomplish here. And therefore, I'm just going to swallow it and play along in the interest of enabling the game he's trying to create. And I know some
Do you think that a player should do that? Do you think that a player...
Generally, no.
But I do.
I generally... Well...
I do, too.
Okay, I don't think a remark like that I can leave unqualified. So let me say that...
Oh, sure you can.
We're Fear the Boot.
This is Fear the Boot, yeah.
I mean, our word is law.
Everything around the table is a give and take. All right, let me say it that way. And it's like Chad has said many times that making a game work right is a team effort. And everyone's a part of that team. The GM's part of the team. The players are part of the team. The wife who's sitting at home while you guys are gaming is part of the team. Or if you're younger than that, the parents upstairs are part of the team. And I think, yes, the GM primarily needs to entertain the players. But I think the players, because the GM is a limited human being with limited resources, do need to cut the GM some slack. And so I would say that, yeah, I think it's right to do that sometimes. If that becomes the bread and butter of your games, you've got a real problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. If every single decision all the player characters are making are concessions to the GM because you think he kind of wants you to go this way, you don't have a game. You have a
box pity canyon. Fest
or a box canyon at best.
Even if the walls of the canyon don't reach up and railroad you in one direction, the plot railroads you in one direction. Yeah. And that's not good GMing. But on the other hand, the players, too. Some people run their games to where it's all about the players. There isn't really a story. There really isn't a plot. And then the players come in and the players start doing their thing, and that creates a story. And the GM just provides a playground for the players to kind of run their drama through, which is cool, but that's not quite how I run my game. You know, I have a story and I have a plot and I have things going on, and I want the players to be a part of that, not to where I am guiding them around, but to where the players are changing that and evolves it. And it's this big gray area of, you know, the players have complete free action and I have complete free action, and the players want me to do one thing and I want to do another thing, and those things converge into this gray area that is the game, that it goes forward and we go forward and we all tell this story together.
I'll take it from a different angle. It is intimidating to me to sit around a table with, okay, there's four people in our principal gaming group, not counting myself running the game. Chad, Dan, John, and Melina. Okay, let's not count Melina because she's never game mastered a game.
So three of your four PCs are primarily GMs.
Are strong GMs, yeah. And it's intimidating because...
And strong personalities,
too. Yeah, as the podcast has, I'm surely, demonstrated, I mean...
But, you know, in all fairness to us, and I don't want to get caught up in any gaming stories, but... In fairness to us, at least as far as I'm aware, it may be intimidating, but we have never done anything to make your life hard as a GM.
Well, part of that is my own neurosis of being unnaturally hard on myself. And you said yourself a couple episodes ago that even though you enjoy the more storyteller aspect of it, there are times during the game where the game master will be doing a description and you'll get bored and you'll just want to get on with the action.
Yeah, and I also says that wasn't good. That's because real life is encroaching on the game time for me. And
that is not something that is unnoticed by the game master, though.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
Well, and also look at the comments that we've made about your game, too. More setting, more detail. Bring, you know, when you step into the barn, just don't say, you walk in the door and step in the barn. You describe the smells and the quality of light and the atmosphere of the barn and... You know, you set
the
stage.
Well, it's about 72% nitrogen, 19% oxygen.
That is a simulation that I need out of my fantasy D&D game.
Well, in the storytelling elements, we've really gotten better on in the last few years. But frankly, I was running Ravenloft back in the 90s.
Well, there's your problem.
And that's one of the problems. And really, in order to get the best result out of Ravenloft, your storytelling abilities have to be out of this world. And mine were not up to par at the time. And so most of my games were basically... breaking down to Richard Pryor games, as we call them, where you're just running scared all the time because I could not get the sort of reactions from players with my storytelling ability.
As I remember it, you were trying to convey the sense that the players should be scared, but it's a D&D game and the players are gods.
Yeah, I mean,
right.
Well, and you reach level 5 or 6 and you are
a story. I didn't give you scenery and rich, heavy sort of environments where you could feel, you know, what your character was feeling. I didn't paint the scene for you well enough. And that was my own greenness as a GM. Yeah.
Well, allow me to play devil's advocate. Now that you recognize your fault, why did you stop?
The Mists of Ravenloft transferred him to DM land, to PC land.
John, a lot of that's been sort of creativity drying up. I mean, I've not been writing for the past few years either, and I just now I'm picking back up the pen, well, the keyboard, but my creativity sort of dried up. I haven't had a lot of ideas for the last several games, too, which, Dan, you know.
And that, in full disclosure, we make jokes about the Mists of Ravenloft. That was Mike's game.
Was it really?
Yeah, it was.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
Wow. Now I feel kind of bad about that joke.
You know,
no, it's fine.
I'd kick this a little bit of a different direction, and I don't want to get into this too much because this is probably a really good full show topic post game design series. But I think part of the problem with horror games in general, and Ravenloft would fall into this category, is it's very, very hard to intimidate the players with anything except combat power because nobody's scared.
Yeah.
Right, because you're not there.
You know, if I really put you in some haunted house walking through it with all the, we lived in a world, okay, where you, everyone completely believes all these things are real because they are real within Ravenloft, you'd be scared to death. But when you have some guy sitting across the kitchen table describing this to you while the guy next to you is munching on Doritos and you're sloshing around the remains of a soda in your cup, it's really hard to be upset.
And see, part of the escape of playing D&D is playing a fearless person. I mean, the Shining Paladin, the gutsy rogue, whatever. A lot of people don't like to play scaredy cat characters.
See, for me, I approach the horror genre from a different angle. I ran one horror game once. I think it was successful because Melina liked it.
Oh, the Seasons game.
The Seasons game. Because,
that was a good game.
Yeah. And I approached it, I never once tried to scare or intimidate the characters. My whole purpose was to set a mood, to set an atmosphere of this feeling, I want to say of horror, but not, again, not to scare the players, but just to set this creepy, dangerous mood throughout the game. And I say I succeeded because Melina was impressed, because Melina, out of all the people in the gaming group, were so into that genre. And I knew that if I could impress her, then I could succeed.
A lot of that is you set the backdrop, though, and you let the mystery of the story itself, you let us imagine the horror of it.
That's an old stage trick.
Well, they say that Hitchcock, 9 times out of 10, is just a shadow, and that's why he's so scary.
You let the you give the mind, as a GM, you give the people's imagination just enough to work with, and then they'll invent the rest.
And in those days that I was GMing, I did not do that well.
Well, we were teenagers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
none of us did anything well. But we had a lot of fun doing it in life and everything.
And I picked Ravenloft for the most part because it was one of the few campaign settings that had good backstory that wasn't already taken. We already had a guy running Dragonlance. We already had a guy running Forgotten Realms. I mean, I had Spelljammer, but between Spelljammer and Ravenloft, that's what you choose.
God!
That is Ravenloft terrible. Every time.
Do you want a hot poker or do you want to be encased in ice for a week?
I rest my case. And I tried Spelljammer, and it was a dismal failure.
Yeah, it was.
How do you work with that?
Well, you call it the Burning Crusade.
Although, Dan, I think...
That's Johnny right. G, you're That's a girl right. after my own heart.
F you.
Although, I actually think Dan actually kind of liked one of my Spelljammer games, if I remember.
Oh, my God, what is this? We're about to have an outing. Come on, Dan. Come on. You like Spelljammer, don't you?
No. Mike ran a game of Spelljammer. And I really liked the character I had.
Okay.
The end result was I greatly enjoyed
it. I read
game.
It for the articles, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Whatever.
I'm just that good that I can make Spelljammer enjoyable.
One day when he's ready.
When he's ready.
All the talk about pornographic magazines actually leads perfectly into our game design topic today of character creation.
Perfect.
Oh, man, that paladin in a third edition book.
Woo, man, that lit up.
Whoa, halfling loving. Can't get better. She has 8+ int skill points, if you get me.
And bonus to dexterity.
Quite so. She's tough to hit, though. That extra point of armor class, she moves around.
And she's just the right height.
Quite right. Her head's a little round, though.
You guys done?
No, we could go forever. What's up, Dan?
Room?
Halfling porn. It's the second half of Lord of the Rings.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't have a player's handbook handy, but I thought Lita was the half elf.
No, she is the halfling rogue.
Oh,
there is no half elf. I don't think there's Mealy, the elven wizard. But
well, come on, you weren't thinking at the end of Return of the King that Sam and Frodo were about to get it on, which you don't know as they
Sam
were.
Sam wanted Rosie Cotton. Thank you very much.
Okay,
did you see Rosie Cotton? I mean, she was she was endowed.
John, you need to impress all the listeners here. You need to name every single D&D character that they have in the book.
In the third edition.
In the third edition.
Player class? Okay. Yeah. Well, let's start with Barbarian. There's Krusk the Half-Orc. Bard,
he does not have a book open.
Oh, yeah, no, hell no.
The only book even near him is an Alternity book and a Battlestar.
That ain't going to help me.
Yeah, which are not going
to
help.
The Bard was changed in 3.5 to, I believe, Gimbal, who was a gnome. The Cleric was, of course, Josen. The Druid, the Druid's going to hang me up. I never play a Druid.
That pasty white guy.
Pasty white. No, she's a chick. She's an elf. She's got a big wolf. You know, whatever. Who the hell cares? It's Druid. Tordek is, of course, the dwarven fighter.
This is scary.
Really
scary.
What comes
after
fighter?
I'm going to call into question Gimbal. I don't think Gimbal's the boss.
Oh, get to 3.5, brother.
Wait, finish your list.
Go ahead and finish your thing. I'll get the book while you're talking.
No, I have fighter? A 3.0 book.
There's no G. There's book. No 3.0. He's not in 3.0. In 3.0, it's like it's an elf or a human or something.
It is a human. You're right.
Okay. There's no G, there's no H, there's no... Oh, there's an illusionist. Illusionist is I. Crap. Nebin! Nebin! He's a gnome. I got it.
Wow.
You can't fool me.
What do you do with your evenings, John?
Not
you're
much.
You're listening to
me. Hold on, we're not done. Continue.
Okay, J, no, K, no, eight. Just screwed up the alphabet.
yeah, you did.
But I know J-K-H the classes. There's no M.
This is why
no
you don't go on
N.
many dates, isn't it?
Is there a sorcerer?
Yes, that is, oh my god.
Oh,
I see him, I see him. He's got a little half-spear, spiky Goku hair.
Oh, and he's got the hand.
Yeah.
Oh, he already does.
Hair. Yeah.
Oh.
He's hair gel man.
I don't know the sorcerer. Screw it. Whatever. Melee's the wizard.
Rogue.
Lita, we've covered Lita. Ranger. Sovelis is the ranger.
Is there a paladin?
Yes.
She.
Alamara or Alamahara or something like that. It's.
And what god does she worship?
I believe it's Pelor. I'm not sure. The sun one. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. The monk is, of course, Ember. Not that we acknowledge the existence of monks in our games, but, you know, she's there. She's got a little bow staff, even though it does 1d6.
She's got
when
that
her fist does,
top
like,
and
4d12. What are you going to do?
What does the second paragraph of page 61 of the Player's Handbook start with, John?
Movement for small creatures is 20 feet, whereas for medium creatures is 30 feet. No, I don't know. I just whipped that in my ass. But seriously, no, my brother's friends long ago learned that if they opened up the PHB and quizzed me, I would know it. So, like, when he's having parties over there and I'm not going out that night, they'll get drunk and quiz me on the Player's Handbook. And it's
scary.
Fun, because I'll kick their ass.
Awesome.
That's gorgeous. Let's move into a topic before we all go to hell for our...
Well, everybody has a talent.
Yep.
That's how he gets the ladies.
That's how I get the ladies.
Quoting from the Player's Handbook.
See, John, Porno Mags went perfectly into character creation. Sample characters in character creation, I don't know how to do this transition.
Well, okay. Actually, all those characters you just named are in the character creation part of the third edition.
Yeah, I know, but where do you go with that to get to character creation?
Yeah.
I mean,
we had the perfect run-in with Porno.
Yeah, Porno Mag's character creation. Character creation, character examples.
The enduring problem with the character creation systems out there is that you just can't make Lita unless you're playing Dungeons & Dragons. So we have no transitions.
All right, well, I guess let's just do a rough change here. And, folks, I apologize to you guys. We'd stick in some kind of bumper or stinger right here, but we don't use those. So let's just go straight into character creation. When we do this game design series, all of this is meant to kind of come in order. So we are assuming that by the time you are talking about character creation, that you have already defined the feel of your game, you have defined the character roles or the just what characters are supposed to do in your universe, and that you have also defined the general model for the character, what attributes you're going to use, how you're going to set up skills. So if we are glossing over all those topics, it's because we assume that at this point in your design, you already have those things. And now all we're trying to figure out is, okay, with that finished character in hand, how exactly do we work forward into the character creation process, or I guess I should say work backwards into the character creation process.
Yeah, how do we get that finished character in hand?
Let's talk about character creation in some other games.
Best and worst?
We'll do best and worst. What do you think some of the best character creation you've seen?
Second edition.
Why?
Because it has cool stat abilities, like Ben Barr's Lift Gates, and the number of henchmen you get.
The word portcullis is
the
on the character
portcullis
sheet.
The word portcullis is on the character sheet. Thank you very much.
I have a vague memory of Traveler from college, and I remember the character creation system was awesome, but I don't remember why. Isn't that helpful?
Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
So far, we have a joke and a failed memory, Adam, Chad, what do you guys got?
A joke.
Seriously.
I don't remember any joke.
Seriously, White Wolf for me. I am not a huge fan of the White Wolf system. It's an okay system. I'm just not a big fanboy of it. But I think their character creation system is really good.
It is pretty good.
Because, I mean, I remember going up to you, Dan. I'm like, look at this. It's dots. They don't do the numbers thing. And it's like, it's 1 through 5. It is a number. They just use dots instead. I'm like, oh, yeah. But the thing is...
You get out your number 2 pencil. And-
the thing is that it's quick. You can make a character really quick. Through the character creation system, you can kind of put a little bit of personality behind it. It is not 100% combat stats. I mean, there are a lot of combat into it. And...
It's interesting because already I can see we're different opinions here about character creation.
Yeah, here we go, yeah.
Because I as well like the White Wolf character creation system, but it is for 2 completely different reasons. Reason 1 is I love the perks and flaws.
Well, yeah. Any system with perks and flaws.
Chad, you put perks and flaws in any system you ever DM, and it's great.
I think that
systems that don't have perks and flaws, they do in my games.
Right, and I think that's great. The second thing is I like the way they don't exactly do character classes, but they still kind of give you an immediate sense of belonging or context in the world through the various clans or packs or orders, depending on the book you're talking about, that you can select. My character came from this particular order, group, or clan, or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I like that because instantly it's a way to kind of clarify your character and his or her role in the world, and also kind of like a perk or flaw is going to set some boundaries and bonuses such that are around the character you're making.
I don't, as we all know, I don't like character classes because I think it pigeonholes and it defines who you are as what you do, and I dislike that. I don't really care for it in White Wolf, but White Wolf does it better because it is more who you are. It's the group that you're a part of. And it even explicitly says in there that, you know, if you belong to this certain clan, these people are like this, they dress like this, they act like this. That doesn't mean you have to, but if you don't, that means you're the odd one out. When you choose a class, you're not just choosing a job. It gives you a place in the world, like you said, gives you a sense of personality, kind of a starting place and where to build up the soft fluff of your character, rather than I'm a fighter, I fight, that means I have armor and a sword. And then I create my character and my story and stuff.
Also, I love the 1 through 5 system as opposed to the cookie-cutter D20 system, which drives me crazy because everybody's using it.
Yeah. Did White Wolf switch over to D20 at any point?
God, I hope not. I don't know the newest version.
Someone has grafted it onto universe.
I could be wrong, but I thought I did at some point see a D20 vampire. I could be completely wrong.
Well, they have a new version out, and I've not read through the books.
I've heard that the new version basically take their old story and nuke it and destroy it and say it never happened or make really huge changes to it, and the big White Wolf fans out there are like, you have just completely ruined the system.
I looked through the books. I think they're just calling it Blanket World of Darkness or something and it looked all right. I need to pick them up.
When making a role-playing game, you have to make a series of engineering trade-offs because, simply put, you just cannot have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah, we ran into this today.
Yeah,
it
we
was
did.
Awful.
So think of it kind of like when you're designing, let's say, a vehicle, a real vehicle in the real world. If you want something that's big and heavy and has massive towing capacity, that thing is not also going to be small and nimble, and the two are exclusive, okay? You get one or you get the other, and you have to decide when you're making a vehicle, where along this continuum do you want your vehicle to fall? And the same thing is true when you're making a game. What we found is, and when we were making Skies of Glass, or working on it earlier today, we put this down kind of into a triangle of things, but I'm going to describe it here actually as 2 separate lines. Line 1 is realism versus game balance. When we were working through Skies of Glass, one of the things we were asking ourselves is, okay, what does a child have up on an adult? And we were able to come up with a couple things. Physiologically, they heal quicker. People tend to assume they're innocent. But all in all, we couldn't come up with much. The adult, assuming they're in good shape, is faster, smarter, stronger, more educated, more wealthy. But here's the thing. If we are going to allow people within our game to play children, there has to be something that makes that fair. So this is one of the first things you got to ask yourself, is at any decision point you make, you have to decide, do I want to create characters in a way that is realistic or do I want to create characters in a way that is balanced and fair?
I would go realistic every time, but that's me.
Well, it all depends on your feel, really.
Yeah.
Depends if you want glitter boys or real human beings.
And I would probably argue with you and say that realistic every time may or may not be just the correct way to go.
Well, one of the other examples we came up with is within most role-playing games, they generally try to keep the characters kind of around the same balance. That if you're weak, it's because you're smart.
Yeah.
Or if you're smart, or you're not that intelligent, rather, it's because you're strong.
And I think that pigeonholes people's characters more so than a character class.
In addition to pigeonholing, I think it's also not terribly realistic.
No.
I can go through my life, and I can name people that are smart, strong, and attractive, and I can name you people that have absolutely none of that going for them.
But in a game, you're going to run into a problem, especially if you're playing with parties, because if Joe has really strong attributes in every area and Bob has nothing, what is he going to be doing in these games?
Right, exactly. And this is the decision you have to make. Are you trying to be very realistic to the way that life actually works, or are you trying to be fair? And these two, we quickly found, are pretty much mutually exclusive. We sat here actually talking through people we know, and then also just celebrities or people that are famous in the news for one reason or another. And we were coming up with people left and right where it's like, well, we wanted to say to have this, whatever that may be, fame, beauty, intelligence, you must lose something else. And we couldn't complete the list.
Yeah, there are people who have everything, and there are people who have nothing. Sorry.
Yeah, that's a matter of perspective.
That's true.
No, I don't think it is.
Yeah, I don't
true.
Think it is.
We were going down the list, and man, we could not work it out. But without bogging down into that, the second of the two continuums is detail versus usability. Now, I realize if you're trying to make a quick play system, and this goes back to what Chad said, that in his mind, a good character creation system is one that very quickly gets out of the way and allows gameplay, then this is really kind of a non-question because you're not going to even worry about this. There is no detail to it. But if you're into a lot of detail, once again, as we were doing Skies of Glass, we kept coming up with these big, long, or approaching these big, long charts you'd have to look at. The question quickly becomes, look, if we put a lot of stuff in there, the game's more detailed, it's more varied, it may arguably be more accurate, but we're also asking
Is the additional accuracy worth
the mess?
Yeah, the 4 extra hours you have to spend
right,
on it.
Right, and people's having to flip forward and backwards and this way and that way and this chart and that chart and the other chart. I remember playing one of the Palladium games that I actually think was one of their better ones. Nightspawn or Nightbane or whatever the final name of it
I've
was.
Always wanted to try that one.
It's a neat game.
We need to play it.
It's a fun game, but you have to make a lot of changes to it to make it be good.
But the character creation system, if you wanted to...
Character creation is awesome in it.
You could create your character and all of his traits completely randomly, which is a neat idea. But because of that, that book is absolutely laden with charts. Another example I'd give would be D&D's random rolls for magic item loot. That's another one where
those are big.
Big, massive charts. So,
but they're fun.
Our charts, big, massive charts, pages and pages and pages and pages of charts, a good thing or a bad thing?
Depends on the players. Dan would probably love it. Chad would probably hate it.
Well, it depends on what you're trying to generate. If you're trying to generate a magic item from nothing, they've got to be huge, or else it means you don't have any magic items in your universe, and that's boring.
Or they're all +1, +2, +3.
Yeah.
I mean, though, even I would draw a line, because I think you hit a point where the charts are so complicated or so large, they become unwieldy.
If I have to have a master's degree to work a chart in a role-playing game, you've missed the boat.
And also, when do you have so many charts that people just stop using the random aspects of them and just start using them as a menu?
Yeah, that's true, too.
Well, DMs need to have their menus, of course. I don't roll on those dice tables every time I want to put a magic item in my game in the back of the DMG. I just pick one out that someone would like.
Something else that kind of bugs me about a lot of character creation systems, and once again, I can't say this is wrong. It just depends on the game. But I wanted to steer away from this, what we're doing. In the vast majority of character creation systems I've played, the games may, and let me start with may, encourage you to write up a personality and background, but the numerics of the character creation system just assumes you sprung from the earth. If I write down on my character sheet, I am 25 years old, then poof, here I am, a 25-year-old man, just like that. I just rolled my attributes all at once, rolled my equipment all at once. There's really no intrinsic sense of history to who this character is that comes out in character creation.
That's one of the good things about Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about this one many times throughout the course of the show. Fastest Archer game is great in that regard because it walks you through the steps of your life, building you upward.
But it's also limited in that regard.
Right.
The only reason it works, and it works well, is because it presupposes that your character will go to high school, go to Starfleet Academy, have a cadet cruise on a ship, and then be assigned to a ship in Starfleet.
True.
I think that's a symptom of the universe.
Of the universe,
not of the character generation.
When people pick up a Star Trek game, I mean, generally I would think that the first thought was, I'm in Starfleet. I get to be on the
bridge. Actually, I'd like to play a Ferengi who had nothing to do with Starfleet. But, you know.
Something else that I've seen vary from game to game is whether you use a fixed system or a random system to create characters. Let me give examples. In Battletech or Shadowrun, you have charts. You pick off the charts what your priorities are. That gives you a certain number of points. You put that into your attributes, put that into your skills, put that into your equipment.
I like fixed systems.
D&D, you've got piles of dice. You roll them. What you get is what you get. You may be able to do some re-rolls or rearranging depending on the system that's being used.
Oh no, Joe rolled higher than me. Now I'm all pissed.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because the difficulty with a random system is obviously it can be horribly unfair. It's extremely unlikely, but one guy at the table could roll on D&D straight threes, and the guy next to him could roll straight
18. That's not 18. At all unlikely. John. It happens in our games all the time. Look at Dan and Kevin and their difference
Adam,
in rolling.
What? Why don't you tell the folks at home your D&D
why
challenge?
Why we have big balls?
Why
Go ahead,
we have
Adam.
Big balls? D&D, straight down the line.
We roll method one. Yes, that method one. 3d6, down the line. No assignment necessary.
Yeah, they don't even, like, rearrange them.
Uh-uh. It's just method one, you can't do that.
Yeah,
that does
That's method
balls.
Three, sir.
The trick is not to declare your player class.
Oh, no. You can't do that. No. We reserve the right to change races and classes as we need to make a barely playable character.
Way back when, that's what you're supposed to do.
I know.
You roll them straight down, and then based on that, you are eligible for certain classes.
Oh, you have to have a 9 in your primary attribute to be one of the four
Paladins
base classes.
Paladins were nearly impossible to
ever roll. Oh, my God. Was
it
like 14 strength? 17 charisma?
Yeah.
What the hell? You know the odds of getting a 17 on a slot you can't reassign on a 3d6?
Yeah.
The flip side with the fixed point systems is you can always make the exact same character every single
yes,
that
time.
Was the problem with Battletech, because the numbers that they used were very low. Was it 1 through 6 or 1 through 10?
1 to 6. 1 to 6.
It was 1 through 6 as a point value system. And there was no difference between the characters. I mean, you could even make a different character, and there's no difference between any of the characters. The differences came out in what skills and advantages you took. And even then, that was limited. This guy was the lucky guy. He took the extra edge. This guy was the noble guy. He took a title and land. This guy
body
was
massage.
This guy was the body massage man.
He was Mr. Body Massage Machine Man.
This guy was the combat hard ass, because he took ambidextrous. And
yeah, Phil, come on.
Sorry. Oh, God, ambidextrous. Every game, there's always one.
Always that one.
You know what this takes us right into is abuses. When you make a character creation system, you have to accept, I think, up front, that you cannot stop every form of abuse imaginable.
And I think that you should probably make every effort to stop abuses.
However, if you look at your system, if your system is just obviously, blatantly wide open to manipulation. Basically what you have done, particularly in groups that are more internally competitive, you have guaranteed that everyone is going to play either the exact same character class or kind of character or configuration of character. You have effectively said that there's only one way to play this game. And if you don't know if your system allows a lot of abuses, pass it around to two or three gaming groups. You'll find out real fast.
You probably know
every,
that guy.
Yeah, every
Give
gaming
it to that
group's
guy.
Got one.
Yeah.
Everybody's got one. Give it to them.
Dan and I will make characters 20, 30 times. We will hand the book to Phil once. He will lay his hand on the book, not flip it open, and will write on a piece of loose leaf stats that blow away whatever we come up with. He's already screwed me out of my own game.
Yeah, we haven't even given him the SOG character generator. He knows how to get a shotgun demon.
In each hand, he's holding a demon with a shotgun.
Yes.
And
he has shotguns that shoot little shotguns.
And as those shotguns fly towards you, they're firing other shotguns at you.
So many shotguns. Man, Phil, you have screwed us.
Something else kind of along the lines of watching for abuse is be sure to leave room for character advancement if you're allowing character advancement. Most people in games like the idea that their character can progress somehow. So if, for example, in your system, let's say skills are on a percentile scale of 1 to 100, if you make it possible to roll off the lines in character creation with a bunch of your skills already at 100, this character, at least in that regard, has nowhere to grow. And that's something you have to keep in mind. How do you deal with that? You could send someone into the game with insufficient skills. You could send someone to the game with skills that are too low or attributes that are too low. You could even just accept it and say, hey, advancement's your opportunity to diversify. But whatever you're doing, be sure to take into account the fact that while most people will probably have their campaigns last, I don't know, a couple months, there are people out there that run these things for a really long time. Or even if they run them for a short time, they do character advancement very quickly. So just take that into account when you're creating the characters. What do you guys think about games that define some of the traits of your character for you during character creation?
Like character death?
Explain that a little bit more.
Like curious and continent toad familiars?
They dictate my hair color? What do you mean?
No, what I mean, well, it could be that. But for example,
only if you're a super
during the Star Trek game, where you have to roll randomly the tours of duty you've had and how they turned out. Or during like that Nightspawn, Nightbane, whatever they end up calling it, game we were talking about, where you could actually, if you wanted to, roll randomly anything you wanted. Your appearance, your magical powers, your emotional quirks. I mean, you could come up with any number of things about yourself.
I like, if you wanted to, you just said about Nightbane or whatever. If you wanted to, that was an option. Yeah. And then in Star Trek, I like the random missions because that may or may not
define your character.
Yeah, that may or not. Yeah. Your character's going to have to deal with things that are assigned to them that they didn't necessarily pick. I mean, that could be a bonus.
I personally love it for a couple reasons. First of all, I think it instantly pushes you out of your rut. Because if you want to make this character who is just perfect and wonderful at everything, and all of a sudden you keep rolling that the only duty you're drawing is merchant
magical
marines,
princess duty, or yeah, the opposite.
But on
the
flip side, you're getting a flat F every single time.
What game is that?
But on the flip side, if you have this great character concept in mind, and then you roll it up, and my character concept won't work now because you've changed several of the things about my character that I had in mind.
I like it in some games. I don't like it in others. I like it in Star Trek. You're part of an organization. And it's this system where it kind of builds your story with you, and you work within the story. It leaves blanks, then you fill in the blanks between the events and stuff. And that's really cool. But I would not want to do that all the time with every single system.
It's good to have there as an option.
Well, I find myself saying a lot of time in those systems, I never would have thought of that, and this is great. I understand, though, why a lot of people wouldn't like it, because a lot of people like complete control over what they're playing.
Yeah.
Even people that are making perfectly reasonable, non-abuse characters, I understand why they would want to do this. I personally, though, think it's wonderful.
That's why it should be there as an option.
Yeah.
I think it should be an option.
Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, it should be an option. I would say, once again, go back to your feel, go back to the kind of game you're trying to create, and just understand there's an up and a down to having it there, there's an up and a down to not having it there, and an option may be a way of skirting between the two.
I think it's a good one.
Aging. As we get older,
2d10 every time. You can be 0, you can be 100, you can be anything.
How do you roll 0 and 100,
and 100
on
the same 2d10? I'm curious about that, too.
Well, when you roll 2 zeros, you flip a coin, heads or tails.
So
2d10.
1d101.
Yes.
All right.
That's crazy. All right. Yeah, you see, that's thinking right there.
So if you're like poor Kevin and you roll 1, how are you supposed to roleplay that exactly?
Oh, that's
a lot of crying
challenge.
And pooping.
That's the challenge.
If you roll 1 or 0.
Well, it's a simple fact of human life, assuming your game is dealing with human life, that at a young age, you're relatively physically weak, don't know a whole lot of things. But as you get older, you hit that kind of downslope where for a lot of your life, you're forgetting things and can't see quite as well and aren't physically like you used to be. And it seems that in a lot of games, like D&D, I know, kind of has that half-ass, well, for every 10 years past a certain age, it's -1 to all physical attributes, +1 to all mental attributes. But it seems like a lot of games really gloss over this, that all characters are equal regardless of age, regardless of experience, that if you take, I'm going to say Shadowrun, but you could insert any game you want just about in there, that if I write up a 6-year-old, a 16-year-old, or a 60-year-old, stat-wise, they will all be the exact same. What do you guys think about it? Is aging just too nitpicky? Is that just too pedantic to really deal with
it? I think it goes back
game?
To the feel. I think in Shadowrun, you want them to be all the same. I mean, it's an action, Shadowrun, skirting the law kind of game, and I don't really think age should play that big of a part in it. But when you're looking at maybe something deeper, let's say a Vampire the Masquerade. I don't know if it does have age take a part of it, but it should, because you could play you're playing a vampire. You could play a vampire who is a 16-year-old human who has turned into a vampire and lives for 100 years, and then that's where you start your game. Or you could play a 16-year-old human who got turned into a vampire last night. There's going to be... Those are two totally different characters, to the point to where I would think that the sheet should represent that.
Yeah, it should.
Well, to some extent, this goes back to our question before of balance versus realism, though.
That's if I want to play
a 75-year-old man, but I want to play a viable character, if I have a good character concept in mind for the 75-year-old man, should you stop me from doing that or limit me from playing a viable character?
No, well, they probably want to be a wizard.
Well, I mean, okay, I've known 75-year-old men that are perfectly viable and functional individuals. The question is, should you have to represent what that age really means? At 75, it ain't all cool. I mean, you've got problems.
Hence my question of realism versus balance.
Well, I think you're already assuming that there's a benefit to being older. Are you reaping a benefit from being older? Then I think you should have a detriment.
Well, that's true.
If you're leveling the playing field and saying your 16-year-old character is just the same as your 75-year-old character, except for a difference in age, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
then the game is balanced.
That's right. If I'm rolling up a just regular old character, by the regular character creation rules, I'm just happen to say, my guy's 75, what's the problem?
Personally, I love playing old guys. I have tons of old characters. I have
geriatric fetish coming through there.
I have a real respect for aged people. I don't know why. I always put into the characters, whether the system allows it or not, quirks that are involved with their age. We were playing BattleTech one time. I played this really old guy. He was in a mech with jump jets. He never used his jump jets, ever, because he had arthritis. And whenever he landed, it hurt like hell. So he never used them. And, you know, I have a laundry list of characters like that where I would add in stuff like that. And I think that it would be really cool if a system allowed that. Maybe not necessarily forced that, because then you're looking at, well, I'm going to make a 60-year-old guy. Okay, roll on the old man table. Okay, well, you've got +2 skills, and you've got -1 limb, and your speed is...
Because every old man loses a limb.
Yeah, it's like,
at 60,
okay,
it just falls off.
It's really crappy when you lose
your... You need to talk to your grandpa about that.
Great, I rolled my torso. Wonderful, I lose my torso.
You must come from a strange family.
Yeah, I think that it would be cool where you have... Like, you could even make it to where, you know, you have normal perks and flaws, but then you have a level of perks and flaws for older people, you have a level of perks and flaws for younger people, or maybe work it into character creation somehow. But, yeah, the more things that you can allow your potential players to do, that it isn't just going to be a little GM nudge-nudge wink-wink side table deal, but that the rules account for and can be combined into the rules, I think it's all the better. Whether you're playing someone young or old, or whether you're playing someone, you know, whatever character concept you can come up with, if the rules can provide for it, all the better within the framework of your field.
You know, I guess another way that I would spin is, let's look at D&D. If I tell you that I am playing a dwarf, that means certain things. I gain certain things, I lose certain things. If I tell you that I am playing a wizard, that means something. I gain certain things, I lose certain things.
And if you tell me you're playing a dwarf wizard, I punch you.
But for some reason, when we come to, I am now playing an extremely old or an extremely young character, now suddenly there's certain people that would expect this to not mean anything anymore.
Well, if you're playing an extremely thin character, an extremely fat character.
Yeah, of course, you know, some of that you could reflect in the stats, but for character creation, it's size of glass. And we are going to post, and I hope to have this up along with the episode, or if it's not up with the episode, it'll be up at some point late this week. We are going to give you guys some kind of stripped-down rules for actual character creation within Skies of Glass. We kind of took some easy ways out because of the fact we're doing this tiered rule system that we talked about in the last episode. We're kind of taking both sides of the realism versus game balance and detail versus usability. But on the end where we actually go into a lot of detail, we have decided that we want to try and help someone walk their character through that character's life. So what we are going to do is use a system of life paths where at every age bracket, so let's say you take the first decade of your life, and you're, let's say you're eventually going to play a character who's 25 years old. So for that first decade of your life, we are going to ask questions like, what were you doing? Were you in a school? Were you in a religious institution? Were you wealthy? Were you poor? And based on that, you are going to get certain points to put into your character for attributes and skills and barter value for equipment. And we are going to keep doing that through each bracket of your life. We also have a chance that at each of those age brackets, you could have what we are calling a life event. And those life events are these just random things you cannot control that are usually bad. They could be good, but are usually bad, that could hit you in the pocketbook, hit you in the skills, or hit you in the attributes. We didn't want to define these into great detail to say, okay, if you're playing a 50-year-old man and in the 50-year age bracket, you shoot 2d6 and roll that you lost some attribute points. We don't say this comes from arthritis. We're leaving that to you, the player, to explain this. But this still kind of puts some random spins into the character that we are hoping the players will use to kind of flesh out and explain some of the things that have happened to them over the years. Plus, given the fact that you have to make declarations about where you were and what you were doing during each of these decades of your life, hopefully this will also nudge characters to think about the backgrounds of their characters and to really get a feel for who they have been, not just who they are on the first day of the game. So we will be putting that up, and if you are not into that, if you're more of a Chad-type player, you just want to get it out of the way, there's rules for that, too, where you can just shoot some dice and get on with the game.
Very few dice.
Maybe just one dice.
Oh, my God. Now you're speaking my language.
Our Skies of Glass question for today comes from Dave, whose foreign name is Ian Harriar. He was looking over our list of barter value and noticed that there was quite a bit of sort of random junk on there. In fact, we actually, I think, have something in there. It's like machine salvage or something to that effect. He was asking, as he goes around the world, and he realizes this is going to vary a little bit from place to place, but exactly how does trade go down? Do people tend to, for example, walk into a city and say, hey, I need some clean water, and I'll trade you a couple of apples and an old bumper sticker for it? The answer to this question is, as you noted, this is going to change from place to place, but the basic answer is yes. That's what that barter value chart is meant to represent.
I thought the answer was, what bumper sticker?
Is
because I mean, like, if it's Dukakis in 88, I mean, I want that thing. I'll give you my grain.
But the point of the barter value chart is to show the relative value of items to these people. It's not just going to vary from place to place, but with an astute game master, it's also going to vary from person to person, because the guy that owns the apple orchard is not going to want your apples, and the person dying of hunger is probably not real interested in your bumper sticker. But the general answer to that is yes, trade absolutely will occur with just a wide variety of random items. Somebody may walk into a shop and say, look, I'll trade you this gun and this box of bullets in return for that horse, saddle, and bag of feed. That's precisely what we're trying to encourage. Because,
and if they say no, you'll trade them one bullet for that horse, bag of saddle, and feed.
Because part of the feel of Skies of Glass is supposed to be that sense of resourcefulness and desperation and scarcity. So to carry that over, we absolutely intended the economy to be used that way. I think that about does it for this episode. So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Ein Ha-ta-ta-ta.
Ta-ta.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.